This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the program is Harriet Williamson. Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. And sitting here in the studio with me is Heather Miller. And she is here with me to encourage listeners to be more than listeners, to also be supporters of the station. That means financial supporters, folks. It means helping to pay part of the cost of keeping the station on the air and keeping it strong, and making certain that when you turn the radio on, whether you're looking for Morning Edition or Focus or Ag News or Afternoon Magazine or you fill in the blank, whatever program you're looking for. It's a full-service programming operation we have here, and it's here because people like you support it with your dollars. So that's what we're asking for. And this will be the last time here this year on Focus that we'll have an opportunity to ask for your support. So, and we have something really special that we're doing just to encourage people to call in. And Heather, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, David, we have an opportunity when you make your pledge by calling 217-244-9455 or online at willpledge.org. You can request a book, a hardcover book, fiction or nonfiction, and for a $40 pledge or more, and we will tuck inside one of our beautiful navy leather debossed bookmarks. Now, what that means is they took the image of the University of Illinois seal and our Focus 30th anniversary and stamped it deep into the leather so it's durable. And it's a lovely way to remind you of just all the wonderful topics that go on Focus. And if you're wondering, how am I going to pay for that pledge? Well, I have a really easy way to pay your pledge. EFT. Electronic funds transfer, and a very simple procedure to make that happen. You write your first month's payment. Say you want to give $120. It's $10 a month. You write a check for $10. You fill out the EFT form that we've included in your pledge packet, put them together in an envelope, and you're done. That's it. It's that simple. But it starts with you and your participation this morning. Get a book. Support the program you love. Get a tax deduction. You heard from David Sinow today. You know, charitable contributions count to the full extent that the law allows. So join us this morning, 217-244-9455, or go online at willpledge.org.
All right. Well, we're very happy to have, as our guest in this hour of Focus, Terry Thies, one of the country's most highly regarded wine writers. He's also in the wine business himself as an importer. He won the James Beard Foundation Award for Outstanding Wine and Spirits Professional. I believe that was in 2008. He's an importer of wines from Germany, Austria, and Champagne. His articles have appeared in the World of Fine Wine magazine. It was Wine and Spirit magazine. Man of the Year 2001, Food and Wine Magazine's Importer of the Year 2006, and a lot of people enjoy reading the things that he has written about a wine and what makes for a beautiful wine and a beautiful wine experience. And some of that you will find in his book, which is titled Reading Between the Wines, which is now available in paperback. It's published by University of California Press. It's a lot of fun to read. You might want to take a look at it, and we're also very pleased to have him talking with us this morning. Also, questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. And Terry Thies, hello.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm okay. I have a little bit of a cold, so if you hear me snorting, you can just call me Snort.
All right. Well, I'm really glad that you could spend some time talking with us. I enjoyed reading the book, and I think the word I have used to describe your approach to wine, I have said irreverent, and thinking more about it, I wasn't sure. I thought maybe I wanted to take that back simply because I know that to you, wine and the experience of wine and getting to know people who make it and appreciating all of the things that it'll do for you, I think you actually do approach it with a certain reverence. But, maybe the thing to say is not stuffy, because certainly wine can be a stuffy activity. How do you feel about it, being referred to as irreverent? Is that okay?
Yeah, it is. It's okay with me. I mean, I'm sort of irreverent towards a lot of the bogus pretension that surrounds the wine community and this whole thing that we do. Mm-hmm. But just because some romance is bogus doesn't mean it all is. So I like to be duly grateful, and if that involves a certain amount of reverence, then so be it, for the beauty of the wine experience at its very best. But it's easy to be precious about it, and you see an awful lot of wine people kind of preening, and there's a certain amount of narcissism, people's adorable palates, and all the rest of it. It's one of the reasons that I wanted to write the book the way I did. There is a syndrome called The Adventures of My Soul Among Masterpieces.
Mm-hmm.
Very easy one to kind of lapse into, because then it becomes all about the spasms of one's own adorable soul and not so much about the nature of the experiences themselves. So I didn't want to write a memoir, and that's been done, and in some cases it's been done very beautifully. And I certainly didn't want to add to the kind of groaning shelves of books that were purporting to demystify wine or make it simple. And all of the basic primers and textbooks have been written and written again. So I thought with my book, if it was going to be durable, which I hoped it would be, that I would go back to first principles and write a book about why somebody should care about wine in the first place.
Hmm. Well, I think the thing that one of the things that strikes me is that while there are many large producers of wine around the world, and many of them turn out a fine product, a quality product. But you think the thing that you have always really spoken up for is smaller producers. And the fact that wine is a very special handcrafted item, and that while industrial strength production can turn out something that's fine, that you can't there's no taking the place of the kind of product that can be made by people who are really connected with the place where it's grown and care a lot about what they're making, even if it's on a relatively small scale.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's kind of analogous to the difference between, let's say, handcrafted American farmhouse cheeses and mass-produced Kraft cheese that you can buy in any conventional grocery store around the country. So I don't think there's anything morally wrong about industrially produced products at all, but that is all they are. They're just products. They're utilitarian, and they are designed for consumers, and in many cases, both in and out of the wine community, they're exquisitely carefully designed for consumers. And it's reasonably well known that there's food scientists, let's say, at the Triscuit people, who have, with fiendish skill, designed that little cracker so that when you eat it, there is a little bit, an aftertaste that compels you to reach for another one. And, you know, all of this has been done to kind of diddle our pleasure centers. And again, I don't think there's anything ethically, morally, or metaphysically wrong with it. But wine can be a lot more than that. And when you have small batch production, a number of things occur. First of all, you have the handcraftedness, if you don't mind the use of a word that's kind of become a bit pretentious now, the artisanality, mm-hmm. that's only available when you have this kind of intimacy of scale. And there's a story embedded in those things. There's, in many cases, there's a family story embedded in it. There's a story of the relationship between the family and its land. Then there is a larger story of the relationship of that individual family with an entire culture of families who have a similar relationship to their land. And then you finally see that there is an aspect of human culture that's doing something beautiful and that I think deserves to be cherished in the world. But before I get too high-flying here, I want to say something to your listeners. This interview that we're doing today has had to be rescheduled because the first time we did it, I absolutely shamefully flaked the time by a couple of hours and was not ready when the phone call came in. And your moderators today turned out to be incredibly generous and sweet people to actually tolerate inviting me back again after my shameful lack of professionalism the first time. So I just want to say that these are good people, folks. Send them money.
Oh, well, thank you very kindly, and please go easier on yourself. You know, these things,
okay.
These things, they happen. You know, we've been doing this show for 30 years now. Little blips, they happen.
Absent-minded authors.
You know, life is too short for bad wine or to get real upset about absent-minded authors. So, no, I wouldn't worry about it. And we really appreciate your spending some time with us. Terry Theis is our guest this morning. You can read about some of his experiences with wine in his book, Reading Between the Wines, which is published now in paperback by University of California Press. It's a lot of fun to read. And it's really not it's not exactly a how-to guide. It's not one of those books that tells you what wine to have with one food. It's not that kind of thing. It's really much more personal, but it also, I think, gives you some insight into what it is that makes wine exciting and what some people say that they experience when they sample a really good glass of wine. So that's what it's all about. And I think if you enjoy food and wine, you would like to read it. And questions are welcome here on the show. Then I think going back to what you were talking about before, just to talk a little bit more about you,
mm-hmm.
I think the thing that really got you interested in wine was having the opportunity and you're really associated with German wine, to spend time in Germany and just to walk around and to visit with people and to get to know the people who made the wine and to have them, you know, stroll with you through the vineyards and talk about what they do. And really, you had the opportunity to, not everybody gets that kind of opportunity, but to really make a connection between the wine, what's in the glass, and the person who made that wine.
Oh, you're correct. And you're also correct that not everybody gets that opportunity. I've tried to be consciously grateful for having had it. When I look back on it now, it was the best possible education a person could have. And, you know, it's a pity that if one does not have those kinds of opportunities, then a really vital piece of the puzzle is missing. What ends up happening is we learn about wine sort of abstractly, theoretically, and it's harder to get a handle on it. Wine is a bit of an unruly mess. I mean, especially these days. If I look back at when I started really caring about wine, we weren't drinking wines from any place in South America, neither from New Zealand nor Australia, neither from most of the countries in the former Eastern Bloc in Europe, and neither from South Africa. Spain was essentially Rioja and bad sparkling wine. And Italy was Chianti and Barolo and supermarket Soave. So when you look at the sheer volume of interesting wines emerging from all these places in the world that were unknown as wine producers, I think, you know, if I were a fledgling wine head right now trying to get a handle on this, I don't know what I would do. I would probably just, you know, throw up my hands and yodel or something. But I was lucky that I was living in Germany. German wines, which subsequently became sort of uncool, were not uncool in those days. It was just another one of the great classic European wine regions. And as it was the one that was closest to me geographically, then it was the one that I traveled most often to. But, you know, I can't emphasize that enough. So I learned about wine by directly being in the vineyards and talking with the people who worked the vines and made the wines. So my process of learning was ineluctably attached to all of those attachments. So I saw wine as a being in context as opposed to a thing or a subject that I needed to kind of wrestle into submission.
Mm. I think thinking about German wine, I guess my experience with German wine is kind of limited. And I would guess that a lot of people, even people who would say that they were interested in wine, probably haven't had much German wine. I think even if you go to a restaurant that has a respectable wine list,
mm-hmm.
there won't be much. Yeah, there'll be German, there'll be French wine, there'll be Italian wine, there'll be wine from California,
right,
maybe from some other places. But I wonder why it is that German wine seems to be kind of neglected.
In many respects, I think it's kind of hard to know, and we are. You know, we're fine wine merchants. We're not sort of marketing gurus here at Theis Selections. And mostly what you try to do when you're trying to figure out your business, whether it's good or bad, is you extrapolate more or less plausible explanations after the fact for what's already taken place. I have a couple of theories about it. I think that when we drink wine, there is kind of a metaphorical participation in the culture, so that when we drink Italian wine, we are slicing off a little chunk of La Dolce Vita.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're drinking French wine, we feel ourselves to be very urbane and seductive. And I suppose that when we're drinking German wine, we feel like Colonel Klink or something like that. There is, I think, an aspect of that. When you think about the German culture, you tend to think either of high-precision engineering, which is, you know, laudable, but it's sort of ice cold, or you think of some buxom waitress with arms as big as your legs, you know, hosting massive steins of beer coming at you. And none of these are particularly kind of attractive images. There's also another weird syndrome. I call it death by umlauts. There are people who are reasonably intrepid when they're standing in front of a Spanish or Italian or French wine label. They are quite willing to try to pronounce the words. If they mangle the words, they laugh it off. But these same otherwise competent and intrepid people, when they're confronted with a German wine label, they suddenly become sort of paralyzed. I mean, it renders them almost infantile. And I've never understood precisely why that should be, because German is a relatively easy language to speak. There are long words, granted, some of them laughably so, but it's a phonetic language, and once a few very basic rules are learned, it's a—I mean, I can read German even if I don't understand what I'm reading, because I know how to pronounce the words. French, Italian, and Spanish are obviously a great deal more euphonious. There's a great line in a James Wright poem about reading Dante aloud. He says, "You can almost feel that there are birds in flight under your tongue."
Ooh,
as you're reading Dante in the original Italian. And I don't think that you're going to have somebody writing poetry like that about Heinrich Heine or Goethe, or Rilke for that matter.
We're here talking this morning with Terry Thies, and we're talking a little bit about wine and about some of his experiences with wine and some of the things that you will find if you take a look at his book, Reading Between the Wines. And we are also here for another reason, and that is to encourage people to support the station financially. And I want to take just a moment here, Terry, if you'll bear with us, to give the phone number for people to call to make a pledge and if they want to go online. We're also doing something a little special here to encourage people to make a pledge. We often interview writers on the show, so we like writers and we like books, and we thought, well, maybe one way we could get people to make a pledge is to say, we have many copies of books that here come into the station, we'll round up some of the best, and we'll offer them to people as a thank you, and we'll also include this nice item that we had made to mark our 30th anniversary, which is a nice leather bookmark that has our logo on there, and it's a cool thing. And so we've said, if people can call in and make a contribution of $40 or more, you can make your choice. You can either have a fiction or a nonfiction book. We'll get it right out to you, and we'll put in one of those leather bookmarks. So we hope that people can take the opportunity to do that here. And Heather Miller is here with me in the studio. She says she likes German wine. She was nodding along when we were talking about German wine.
Absolutely. I like Riesling.
Admirable taste.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
I like the Cabernet style of Riesling, actually. I like a little drier wine, but I think a lot of people think that the Germans hold the market on dessert wine.
Yeah, it's kind of silly, really.
It really is. But what's not silly is supporting a conversation just like this during Focus and our pledge drive, and for a $75 gift, we'll send you Terry's book. And this, I'm excited. I have a pledge online. I haven't got my gift selected, but I do now. And I'm getting your book, Terry. I can't wait to read it.
It's very sweet. So for $75, I get my book. I'll tell you,
absolutely.
Know, for $125, I'll show up at your house.
And he'll bring wine.
I'll bring wine. And
you'll bring a Riesling?
Read the book out loud.
Yeah, okay, very good. Well, you can't hardly beat an offer like that, ladies and gentlemen. Seriously, though, we got a couple things going. If you would just like to have one of our gift books, fiction, nonfiction, you can do that. All you need to do is $40 on that. But if you can do $75, we do have Terry's book. And it's a lot of fun. And I really think that people who enjoy wine and enjoy food and like cooking and like to explore all the great flavors and things that you can do with food and wine and just think it's sometimes a great glass of wine, it's just a great experience, that you will really enjoy reading reading between the lines, I promise you. So if you can make that kind of contribution, that would be really great.
And the number to call to get that book,
no,
which
that,
is what I'm going to do, 217-244-9455. Or go online at willpledge.org.
All right. Well, once again, our guest this morning is Terry Thies. He is the winner of the 2008 James Beard Foundation Award for Outstanding Wine and Spirits Professional. And he is an importer of boutique wines from Germany, Austria, and also from the Champagne region of France. And he is well known for writing about and talking about wine. And again, there's a book that you might like to take a look at. Reading Between the Wines is the title, and it's published now in paper by University of California Press. Well, we do have a caller to bring into the conversation here, and that's certainly welcome. As always, people want to call in, share some of their wine thoughts with us, 333-9455, and a toll-free 800-222-9455. And the caller is in Charleston, I believe, on line four, toll-free line. Hello.
You believe correctly.
Yes.
From Charleston.
Hi. Yes.
I, too, would like to come to the defense of the German wines. They're marvelous.
Thank you.
I had the fortunate experience of teaching for the University of Maryland in their overseas program years ago, and it was stationed in a small little town near Trier. And it wasn't too far of a drive to get to the town of Peaceporter along the Mosel. And whenever I see that wine or that label in our local stores, it's, oh, I got to grab that. I remember being there. And the wine festivals in the spring in Bernkastel-Kues and other places of the wine, it's just, they're just great memories. And I think that ties in with Peter's place of, you know, he learned the wine by talking to the people. And it's just those great memories that ties me back in.
Mm, I appreciate that. So you and I had a certain aspect of our lives in common. Yeah, I was also very fortunate. German vintners were the first whom I ever met, and they were extraordinarily generous. And, I mean, generous with their time, generous with their samples. They seemed surprised. In those days, I looked, you know, kind of a bit like a hippie bum. And I don't think that many of them had been sort of beset upon by some hirsute freak who looked like he ought to be the lead guitarist in a metal band, who was that curious and asking those kinds of questions about wine. So there seemed to be almost no limit to the time that they would spend with me. And without wanting to cast aspersions upon any of the other noble wine citizenry elsewhere in Europe, I sort of felt like, wow, if the Germans are this nice and generous, then imagine how the French must be. And in fact, I found that the Germans were and remain the most open, the most hospitable, the most generous with their time and with their samples of any people whom I've ever had the pleasure of meeting in the wine world. So, it's all good.
I had a chance to travel to the southern part of France and just pop into a vineyard here and there. And again, the small wineries, they were, you know, very hospitable as well. And then also in northern Italy. I don't know. I seem to find myself surrounded by wine. We've recently made a purchase of a small home in Sonoma, and we're looking forward to spending more time there too. I wanted to point out, and I really hope our big grocery store owners aren't listening to this, but with the German wines, I've learned it's best to look for that magic phrase, Qualitätswein mit Prädikat. Apparently that's the top appellation that the German wine industry gives to its wines. Is that?
Yes, but I must update you.
Oh.
In the last couple of years, that somewhat unwieldy phrase has been simplified. There are now two categories. The lesser of them is simply called Qualitätswein, and the higher is called Prädikatswein.
Okay. I had seen that, and I was wondering, wait a minute, is that the same thing? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And all that really means, it harkens back to when the German wine law was written in 1971, and I won't get too geeky about this, but those were the days before climate change, and you couldn't presume upon ripe grapes in Germany in those days.
Hmm.
So what you very often needed to do in order to correct for a deficiency in ripeness was you added sugar to the grape juice. The yeasts in the grape juice could not distinguish between the sugar already there and the sugar that you dumped in. So it just went on its merry business converting all of it to alcohol. So you had a wine that had the necessary body by dint of the addition of a little bit of sugar. The French had a laconic way of referring to that as sunshine in bags. which I was kind of funny. So that process, named after the person who created it, is called Schaptalization. And Qualitätswein in Germany can be Schaptalized. Prädikatswein cannot be. The assumption there being the grapes were ripe enough to have done without it. Now, in fact, in the last 10, 15 years in Germany, Schaptalization is almost unheard of anymore because ripe grapes are the norm. So there's a young generation of vintners whom I wonder if they've even forgotten how to Schaptalize. Last time they needed to do it was in a couple of instances in sort of marginal land in the 2008 vintage. So a lot has changed, and Germany's not like it used to be. And, of course, the common rap against the wines is, and the common rap against Riesling in general, is that it's sweet,
yeah.
Which, you know, is honestly is sort of incomprehensible to me because we consume sweetness in manifold forms. Mm. That Riesling Cabinet, David, that your colleague enjoys, probably has approximately two-thirds less sweetness than Coca-Cola.
Hmm.
Coke has 116 grams per liter of residual sugar, and that Cabinet that your colleague enjoys probably has about 35 or 40. So I've often wondered about the fact that we are quite happy to snarf down sweetness in all these other forms, and yet somehow when it takes the form of wine, we think it's uncool. And that I don't really get. But I will say that if you're a person who really doesn't like sweet things, then please invite me to go on a picnic with you because I'll eat all the incredibly beautiful, plump, dewy, ripe strawberries at the top of the basket, and you can have all the runty little yucky green ones on the bottom.
I wholeheartedly agree. Sometimes I like a good sharp peppery red, and other times, oh, a nice sweet white, especially in the summertime. A cool white.
Yeah,
thank
with
you
low
very
alcohol.
Much.
Yeah. Well, that's something, again, I think if you're looking for something to appreciate or to say as a selling point, if one of the things that you'll find on a bottle of wine and you take a look at it, it'll tell you what the alcohol content is. And there are some big, you know, particularly like big Italian wines that could be 16%, 17%. And while you know those wines are great, it can be a little problematic alcohol at those levels, and I think you would say one of the advantages of the German wines is that they actually are lower in alcohol, and there are a number of reasons why that's good.
Yeah, especially the next morning.
Yes, indeed.
And you know, it's not uncommon in these days to find a German wine with alcohol as low as 7.5%. And the ones with sweetness, they tend to top out at around 11. So, you know, this whole community of wines that have less alcohol than Belgian ales.
Yeah.
And I think it's lovely. I mean, you know, one can't really conceive of wine without alcohol, but that doesn't mean that more is always better. And again, when I began drinking wine, the average red Bordeaux had alcohol levels of about 11.5%. Chianti was 12%. And look at them now. I mean, this, again, is an aspect of climate change. But it's also created quite the dichotomy of taste in the wine community, and there's a certain number of people, myself included, who are really beginning to wonder what we are losing by refusing to drink anything with alcohol of 14% or higher. I know that for me, the odds of being pleased by a wine decline precipitously above 14% by volume. So it has begun to occur. It's begun to occur to me that I might actually consider boycotting those wines, which seems a little foolish. And yes, it's an arbitrary line that one draws, but you always have to draw a line somewhere, and that one makes more sense than any of the other arbitrary lines I thought I could draw. And believe me, in order to get complexity, flavor, intensity, fascination, food friendliness, all the things that we go to wine for, you don't have to accept these medicinally hot, high levels of alcohol into the bargain.
Yeah.
You don't have to.
I want to have you talk a little bit more about Riesling. You've been, as I said, you've really been a big advocate for German wines and also particularly for Riesling. And maybe for people who don't have a lot of experience with Riesling, what is it that you find about that variety that's so pleasing?
Oh, God, so many things. It's almost impossible to know where to start. First of all, it is just that. It's a grape variety. Mm-hmm. Lots of people conflate the name or the word of Riesling with the style of wine that they think it invariably makes. That is a sweet wine. But Riesling is a grape variety from which all kinds of wines can be made. It can make a sparkling wine. It can make a bone-dry wine. It can make a wine with a teensy bit of sweetness or a wine with a discernible amount of sweetness, like, say, an apple, or a wine with a great deal of sweetness, like a peach, or a wine with a honeyed sweetness. And it makes everything in the continuum. So lose, first of all, the notion that Riesling is invariably a sweet wine. In fact, there is more dry Riesling produced in the world than there is not dry Riesling. The other thing is, it's truly a noble vine. It needs about 115 days between the end of flowering and the harvest before it's fully ripe. So it's on the vine a long time. And it tends to grow very well in poor soils in northerly climates. And in order to do that, you have to plant it in outstanding land, usually very steep land. In steep vineyards, you have to have very poor soil. Otherwise, every time it rained, the soil would erode all the way down to the bottom of the hill. So what you need to have is very porous soils. The vine is a creature that needs an aquifer. It looks for a source of moisture, and it will plunge its roots down into the soil until it finds a ready source of moisture. If your topsoils are poor, then Riesling is plunging its roots down through all of these different geological strata and sending out little root filaments into what can be tremendously complex geological soils. And all of this complexity with 115 days of time on the vine is ending up in the wine. The last thing I think that makes Riesling so remarkable is during the crucial point in its ripening, it's no longer hot outside. The nights are cold, the days are mild. So you have, first of all, very wide swings of day and night temperatures, which help to preserve aroma. And then you can increase the sweetness in the grapes without losing acidity. So it is the final kind of masterly touch of Riesling that even when it is sweet, it always has this incredibly refreshing spine of acidity that makes that sweetness much more akin to the sweetness of an apple than to the sweetness of a Twinkie. Mm. So, yeah, Riesling is royalty. I think it's the greatest grape from which wine is made, of either color. And the final thing about Riesling's virtues to be extolled is it's a very resistant to manipulation and diddling. The flavor of Riesling is already almost fully present at the time that the grapes are picked and the juice is pressed. The cellar master really doesn't need to do anything to it. The cellar master sees his role as preserving the inherent flavor that was already there. So I like that about Riesling. It comes out of the ground fully formed, and it tends to create a sort of an admirable craftsman-like humility on the part of the people who make it. They just say, hey, we're working with nature to make sure the grapes are really perfect. And then we are getting out of the way.
Our guest in this hour is Terry Thies. He's an award-winning wine professional. He is an importer of boutique wines from Germany, Austria, Champagne. He's also certainly well-known for writing about and talking about the pleasures of wine. And that's what we're doing this morning in this hour of Focus. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Support comes from Subaru of Champaign County, located on Route 45 in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieved zero landfill status, with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill.
Noble.
It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're having a good time here this morning talking with Terry Thies. Heather Miller is here with me, too, and because we are encouraging people to support the station. And as an incentive, we have copies of Terry's book. I mentioned that a couple times here, Reading Between the Wines. It's really a lot of fun. I really think that people who you enjoy food and wine, you would enjoy reading this book and enjoy sampling his approach to thinking about wine, and what makes a good wine and what the experience is all about. And he has an unusual and special way of writing about it. And, you know, as it's, I think I've said here in talking about the book, that to try to describe the way something tastes is really difficult. And especially to do it in a way that somebody else would get it when you said, oh, I understand what you're talking about. I think he has a very interesting way of trying to talk about what the experience is of a glass of wine. So you will enjoy this. So, Heather, what are we asking if people will make a contribution?
We're looking for a $75 pledge for this book by Terry this morning. If $75 fits your budget, that's terrific. You can use your credit card, your Visa, your MasterCard, American Express, or Discover. If you prefer, you can use EFT, Electronic Funds Transfer, for a $120 pledge. Because we'll take more than $75 for this wonderful book. You're supporting the program here, folks, and this is the last day of our December drive, so be generous with EFT. That's just $10 a month. That's very easy to do. You write your first month's payment. You include the EFT form that we've mailed you. Fill it out, and you're done. Your support is there. You'll get this wonderful book. And like I said, I can't wait to read it over the Christmas holiday. I'm totally excited about this. I love wine. I love trying new things. And I love learning a little more about it. And that's what happens when you listen to Focus and you keep that going when you support it with your pledge call. 217-244-9455. Or willpledge.org.
All right. Well, we'll get back to our guest, Terry Thies. We have somebody here, Terry, on the telephone, another caller. So let's talk with them, someone in Urbana on our line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
You're talking about the Rieslings. I wanted to call him. One of my favorite vintners, he passed away just a couple years ago, was an Austrian named Kracher.
And oh, yes.
The most marvelous wines I think made in the world. Just incredible wines.
Was that someone you know, Terry? You're new?
Yeah, although he didn't make Riesling, as it happens. He was is actually a great dessert wine producer in Austria. His son has taken over the estate and really hasn't missed much of a beat. But, yeah, Louis Kracher was certainly an international wine personage and much beloved by all who knew him, and his passing was really shocking.
I guess a lot of the wines weren't maybe Riesling. They were Riesling varieties or Riesling.
Yeah, well, he makes mostly dessert wines from. Riesling doesn't grow in that part of Austria. It's a little bit too hot for it, and the soils aren't right. But he does make fantastic dessert wines from Pinot Blanc, and there is a variety called Welsh Riesling, which is actually not genetically related to true Riesling. I'm not exactly sure why the EU continues to permit them to use the name, but. I applaud and second your high regard for Kracher, and you'll be happy to learn that the estate goes on.
Oh, that's great to hear. That's good. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Again, well, other questions, certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I do have an email here, and this is a little bit of a challenge for you, see what you might have to say.
Okay.
We have someone says that they're going to be having a party, and I want to know, what might I select for a party with a buffet featuring mid- to strong-flavored small bites? The person goes on to say, many of my guests will be beer drinkers, but there will be wine drinkers as well, and they know that there are at least a couple of people who can't drink red wine.
Mm.
So what do you think?
I'm going to do the best I can with the information that I have.
Okay.
Mid to strong flavored small bites doesn't actually tell me enough. But as a general rule, and of course depending upon your budget, you can't really go wrong with sparkling wine. And champagne, obviously, if it fits the budget. And if it doesn't, there are good alternatives, both imported and domestic. I think that a German or German-style wine, that is to say a Riesling that has what I like to call a kind of stealth sweetness, where you get it onto the palate and you have a first impression, oh, this is a bit sweet, and then it's on your palate for 5 seconds, and you think, actually, no, it's not sweet, it's rather dry, and it has a clean sort of crisp, dry finish. Those kinds of compromise wines, if you will, tend to find a way to work with a wide variety of different flavors. So it's what I would do, if I were sort of extrapolating from a hypothetical buffet table.
Okay. Well, hopefully that helps. Other questions, comments, email is certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. And that email is well-talk@illinois.edu. Well, since I did want to have you talk a little bit about sparkling wine, since we're now coming up to the time of the year when people are going to be having parties and celebrating, and a lot of folks would like to include that.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people, you know, when they think of whether it came from the Champagne region or not, when they think sparkling wine, they think champagne.
Right.
If you go into a place where they sell good wine and you say to them, "So I'd like a bottle of French champagne," be prepared because it has become very expensive. For people who don't care particularly that it has to be champagne from Champagne, well, what do you think is a way to approach this idea of looking for a pleasing sparkling wine?
Champagne, true champagne, is actually a very beautiful wine, and a wine that's worth cherishing, and that is to say, a wine that's worth appreciating when it's consumed. And in that sense, I'm not entirely certain that it's the most ideal wine for celebratory purposes, because for the most part, you're not really focusing on the taste of the beverage. You're just raising a glass and slugging it down. Mm-hmm. And you're celebrating making it through another year or getting the promotion or getting whatever it is that you're celebrating. And so in that sense, I would just say the smartest thing to do is you determine what your budget is. You go to a wine shop where you can trust the people, and you just say, "I need a sparkling wine for celebration, and this is what I want to spend. What's the best you've got?"
Okay.
And that's always, by the way, an extremely useful strategy. Your local retailer is the person with the most vested interest in making you happy. And he wants you to come back, or she wants you to come back to the store saying, "That wine you sold me last week was really delicious. What else have you got?" That really makes them glad.
Yeah.
You build a relationship of trust with those people, and you really can't go wrong. So, but coming back to champagne for a minute, it's both a blessing and a curse that champagne is kind of ghettoized as a beverage of celebration that is, you know, typically consumed during the latter 3 weeks of the year, when in fact champagne is a lovely wine for food. And I think, though it has certainly left the area where it's everyday priced wine, I think that dollar for dollar, the money that you spend on champagne will not buy you better wine from any other wine category.
Hmm. Well, what people, I'm sure that they have in mind, let's set aside price for a moment, because for some people that really will be a deal breaker. But, you know, you think about the most prestigious sparkling wines, and you think things like Dom Pérignon. And Veuve Clicquot, and there are a few. These are French wines, and they're very old names, and they're quite expensive, and some things that some people will never experience. If you're looking, though, for a great experience, and maybe you are, you can spend $40 for a bottle, and you'd like to sample the product of not an industrial producer, as good as Dom Pérignon is, that it is an industrial producer. How would you go about that?
You first of all try to get sort of clear on the concept. The big champagne brands are indeed industrially produced. They are, in most cases, they're arms of multinational luxury goods conglomerates like Clicquot and Moët and Chandon, which belong to the LVMH empire. So, again, nothing morally wrong with those things, but one should understand what they actually are. There are a lot of small growers who are growing their own grapes, producing and bottling their own champagne, and you could refer to them maybe as microbrew champagnes if you found that an easier way to kind of grok them. Mm-hmm. And you could look at the big houses almost like Bud Miller and Coors. And so the first thing to do would be to go into your local wine shop and ask for a grower champagne and hope that they know what you're talking about. And And you'll know that you're in the company of an excellent retail wine merchant if he says, oh, yes, we've got lots of them, and he walks you over to the shelf and shows them all to you. You'll know that you've got something to teach this person if you go in and ask him for a grower champagne and his jaw sort of falls and he goes, uh-huh. But when I began importing grower champagnes into the U.S. in 1997, there were 33 of them on the U.S. market. As of 2010, there were 186 of them. So there are more and more all the time. And it's an idea whose time has definitely come.
And can you get something that will be pleasing for, let us say, less than $30 a bottle?
That's going to be a little bit hard to do. Just based upon the production costs of champagne and the still relatively weak value of the U.S. dollar against the euro, you can certainly get something just delicious at the $40 range, $40 to $45. But at or below $30, what you're very likely to be getting will be industrial champagne that's priced as a loss leader just in order to bring people into the store. So if you look in the wine and liquor ads in, you know, most big city newspapers around the country, particularly at this time of year, you'll see some of those big brands really being kind of footballed around. And one guy will have the champagne for $29.99, and the next guy will have it for $29.89. So they'll be competing with one another to see who can lose more money on the big brand just to get you into the store.
Yeah, okay.
For the consumer, of course, it's a bargain. If you will, but it's you've got to wonder what you're getting.
All right, we got one more caller here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi, thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
Terry, I just wanted to say that I used to work in the wine industry. You know, I started off as a waiter and worked on wine lists, and then eventually did some distribution and wine store. There's about three or four people that I've always found to be just extremely cogent writers. You know, for example, like Kermit Lynch or Brian Jancis Robinson. But I really have enjoyed this quite a bit. I'm very much looking forward to reading the book. And I just wanted to say thank you for being one of the few people in the industry that values interesting things, quality, and also keeps their standards very high. And I met you once up in Chicago, and I just wanted to say thank you very much for all your efforts.
Well, thanks for helping me be possible for me to make the efforts.
All right. Well, indeed, thanks for the call. We're coming down to the point here where we maybe have a minute or two left. I don't know if there's anything really general you could say about for folks. Say, all right, you're at a restaurant, you've selected a wine, you bought a bottle of wine, and you brought it home, and you've opened it up, and you put it in the glass, and here you go. You're going to take your first sips. Is there anything you could say to people about how to do that, or do you just say, don't worry about that, just drink it and see how, you know, what does it do for you?
A thing that I'm fond of saying is that wine will meet you wherever you are. If it's just a little refreshing beverage, then let it just be that. And if you care enough about it to actually consider what it is you're drinking, then you'll find in wine a perpetually renewable source of interest and fascination. And one other word, a lot of us worry that we don't have this arcane thing called a good palate. We don't know what it is. We don't know how to recognize if ours is one. And I'll say this, a palate is the quality of attention that you pay to what you're tasting and memory. It is only those two things. So if you pause to consider what you're tasting, maybe scribble down a few words so that you can remember what you tasted, then eventually you're going to have a sort of a database of memory, and you'll be drinking wine with more perspective and context than ever before, and suddenly you'll realize, gosh, I must have a good palate.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for spending some time with us. We certainly appreciate it.
Oh, me too.
And for people who would like to read more of our guest writing, the book you should look for is Reading Between the Wines. It is now available in a paperback edition. It's published by the University of California Press. Our guest, Terry Theis, his last name is spelled T-H-E-I-S-E, winner of the 2008 James Beard Foundation Award for Outstanding Wine and Spirits Professional. He's well known for importing wines from Germany, Austria, and the Champagne region of France. He's also written articles, appeared in a number of places, including the World of Fine Wine magazine. And again, Terry, just thanks very much. Really enjoyed it.
My pleasure.